Good morning, everybody, and welcome to this morning's overview of Public Act 189 concerning student data privacy. My name is Doug Casey. I'm with the State Commission for Educational Technology, and we are really grateful for the time and insights of Shipman and Goodwin on this important and time-sensitive topic. Before we begin, I just wanted to share that we have a large audience of nearly 100 attendees, and so in order to offer you the best sound quality, we are going to keep all of our callers on mute. We've collected and shared the questions that you submitted when you registered, and we'll make every effort to address them during the call. We're also recording the call, and we'll provide a link to the recording to everyone who registers. As we took a look at the bill's development and provided comment on its final draft, we recognized the need for clarifications to district leaders on how the law would impact schools. While the new law provides minimum privacy and contractual standards that districts can leverage, it also provides clear language on the types of disclosures and notifications that schools need to provide regarding access to student data by third-party providers. So given that most districts use some forms of cloud computing and external hosting for their student data applications, not to mention potentially hundreds of device-based apps, the law has a lot of policy and operational implications. Not surprisingly, many school technology, business, and student services leaders have expressed a need for assistance regarding possible work that they need to do to prepare for the bill that becomes law on October 1st. And so we felt this briefing would help answer questions and jumpstart planning for any measures that districts feel they need to take this summer. So with that, I would like to introduce our presenters. Gwen Zatoun serves as counsel with Shipman and Goodwin and will address definitions and Board of Education obligations. Bill Roberts will follow after Gwen, and Bill serves as an associate with the firm. He will address operator obligations and breach provisions. And then after that point, our partners with Shipman and Goodwin will follow those issues with responses to the questions that you, the audience, has submitted in advance. So with that, Gwen, I will turn it over to you.
Thanks very much, Doug. I also want to add that we're also here with our colleague, Ben Frazzini, who's going to chime in on some of the specifics for contractors. So he's going to help us out as well. We're glad to have such a large audience here with us today. But we want to also make clear that we're here to paint some broad strokes as to what the law requires as we have read it. We'll tell you up front, and this isn't just a plug for legal advice, but we'll tell you up front that it's a really good idea to go through what you've got in your district and relative to technology and student records issues, and then consult with your counsel specifically as to your specific needs. So a lot of the questions we got were very broad. Some of them were more specific, and we're going to have to leave a lot of those specifics up to the individual needs of districts. So we do urge you to do that. I know both CABE and Shipman and Goodwin, we are in the process of reviewing and revising our policies. I know from Shipman and Goodwin's perspective, ours will be done midsummer. We're also in the process of drafting some sample model notices and contracts to be used, so look for those either from CABE. I don't know what they're doing relative to contracts and notices, but I imagine they'll have some really good information as well. We do our very best to put our legal minds on these new laws, but there are still going to be a lot of lingering questions for everyone. I note that the law includes a task force, which will include a number of stakeholders who are obligated to come together prior to January and put together some recommendations, so we're hoping some good information comes out of that. And I know we have spoken also with Doug about reconvening again in the fall and having some more in-depth conversations as more information comes to light. So we're going to do our best today to plug through the new law and provide some guidance as much as we can. I'm hoping everyone was able to access kind of a summary that we put together with just some bullets as to what we as districts, school districts, need to be aware of going into October 1. I'm going to be working off of that very loosely. I'm not going to sit here and read it, but I'm going to provide some commentary and hopefully some helpful information. I wanted to start off by saying that I had a question once about, is this just really the same old that we've been required to do under FERPA? Now it's just written down. And to some extent, yes. And FERPA has always required us to take certain precautions and to engage our consultants and school officials, I use that term in quotations, school officials, to require them to engage in certain securities of student data. And it's what we've been advising our clients to do for some time now. So this certainly makes it a lot more specific and puts much I would say clearer definition as to who it applies to. I don't know how clear it is, but it's definitely further information. So it definitely builds on the requirements of FERPA, and as you can see, they build in definitions that are already included in FERPA. So some of those definitions have not changed. Personally identifiable information is what we have known it to be from FERPA for many years now. There are certainly some additional definitions that we have to work through, definitions of student records, definitions of student-generated content, and definitions of, I believe it's student information, now that I don't have that particular word in front of me. So they are all have a little bit of differences amongst them. Interestingly, student information doesn't have to be maintained by the district, which I think is that's really the essence of that definition. So it's not just us as a district maintaining information. We're talking about what third parties have our information as well. And then the definitions of student records are certainly much broader also. We're not going to walk through the specifics of the definitions, but safe to say that when we reference student data, we're going to be talking about, through this presentation here, all three terms, student information, student records, and student-generated content, because a majority of this law applies to all three, and certainly the contract provisions do apply to all three. So that's going to bring us to the specifics of what are those contracts, what is this going to look like, who does this apply to. So in accordance with this new law, the Board of Ed, after October 1, 2016, when they engage in an agreement, a relationship with a contractor, has to have a written contract. So who is a contractor? A contractor is going to be either an operator or a consultant. An operator is someone who runs, manages, operates, so to speak, an internet website, an online service, or a mobile application. And any consultant is an individual who provides non-instructional services and provides essentially administrative or other services that are non-instructional to the district, and they are in possession of or have access to student information, student records, student-generated content, so any student data. And it's not just that we're handing it over, but it's that they are able to access it. So it's pretty broad. What I think is really important, and I know that we have a lot of technology representatives on this call right now, but it's important to go back to your districts and tell them that it isn't just about electronic information. The law is much broader than that. So it applies to operators, but it also applies to your consultants who provide non-instructional services, which will impact a variety of other areas in your district, including but certainly not limited to special education. For example, when a school district or a planning and placement team, a PPT, decides to evaluate a student using an evaluator who is not a school employee, this law will likely apply. When a school district, you know, through special ed again, enlists certain assistive technology, this law might apply. Bringing in any outside individual to provide any of those types of consultative services, you're going to need to put together these contracts with those individuals. So, yes, we have to be looking at that technology end and what kinds of mobile applications are we using, what kinds of online services are we using, but we can't forget about that other side, which happens as a matter of course. as a regular process through the PPTs, through our special ed departments, through other aspects of our districts as well. So I don't want to lose sight of that. On the operator side, knowing the workings of a school district, and this is certainly not a limited number of things that it will apply to, but it is going to likely apply to your student data systems, your power schools, your infinite campuses, plus your IEP directs. Any type of online system, internet-based system where there is a collection of data. And then it's going to likely apply, and I know Bill and Ben are going to address this more, but it's likely going to apply to those online or web-based services that we might not always know a lot about. So what apps are we using in our classrooms? What are those apps doing? Are they collecting information? Are they producing student-generated content? Is it a system where a teacher or an administrator is inputting data? What is going to be of utmost importance is that an inventory of systems is conducted in each district so that there is knowledge as to what we have and what we are using and what our individual teachers using, because we now have to enter into these contracts with very specific requirements. And we're going to get to your questions again at the end, but there were a lot of questions about terms of service, and after we get through all these definitions, we're going to address those specific questions. So the requirement is that once we are engaging in a relationship with a contractor, we have to develop a written contract. There's no definition of written contract in the law, in this specific law. A contract generally doesn't have to be in writing, as we know it as a general legal term. It's an agreement between two parties for consideration, which is just one person giving something to the other and the other giving something in return. That said, there are a lot of specifics that have to be in this written agreement. There's no signature required. That's not required by the law. It's not required by contract law generally, except for specific areas, and it was not delineated in this law. We certainly would recommend from our perspective, from our clients, that they do obtain signatures, but it's not specifically required by this law. Again, these requirements are for any contract entered into on or after October 1, 2016, any contract renewed or entered into or revised after that date, these requirements apply. They don't apply before that time, although you certainly would want to get your systems running and get things ready to go for that October 1 date. Any contract renewed, revised, entered into after that date has to include these provisions. If it doesn't, by law, it's void. And any contract that has provisions that are contrary to the requirements of this law, those provisions are going to be void as well. This is a pretty strict requirement, and I'm getting nods from around the table here, is that we rarely see that written into a law, that it's clear that this requirement is absolute on or after this date. So let's get into a little bit about what the specifics are that have to be in the contract. The first is a statement that's, again, student data. We're using student data as a term to encompass all three of those definitions, are not the property of or under the control of a contractor. And this is actually the same requirement that is under FERPA. When we use a school official, that information still belongs to the school district or possibly the student if it's student-generated content. Number two is a description of the means by which the Board of Ed may request the deletion of student data in the possession of the contractor. So we're going to have to craft a means by which we are able to request that, and it's certainly going to occur if and when that contract ends, that we ensure that data is not then floating out there, that it's deleted or properly returned to either the district and or the student or parent. Number three, a statement the contractor will not use student data for purposes other than those authorized pursuant to the contract. And Ben's going to get into this a little bit more, but safe to say that the contract also then has to have a purpose for the data, which is not a enumerated requirement, but it is clear that it cannot be just a generalized sharing of information. There has to be a purpose for the use of the data. That is actually a requirement under FERPA for consent as well. We have to know the reason that we're sharing data. So this is now written into these contracts. There has to be a purpose that this third party is using this information and cannot be used for any other reason. Number four, a description of the procedures by which a student, parent, or guardian may review this information and correct erroneous information. So there has to be a process. Similarly, FERPA already has this process, whereby parents or eligible students can review student records and request amendment. So this is not very new to us. What is going to be new, and this applies to a variety of these provisions, is that we have to be able to access that information. And for some, it's not difficult. For example, our student data systems, we generally have access to all of the information that we put in. What I think is going to be more difficult is for the mobile apps that we're using and some other instructional tools, perhaps, that maybe it's not as easy to access that information and correct it. So those are things that we're going to have to work through as we plow through this law. Number five, a statement that the contractor shall take actions designed to ensure the security and confidentiality of student records. Again, this is a requirement under FERPA for school officials, but we have to make sure that whatever third parties we are using, that they have sufficient protections on their systems. Given the state of affairs currently, I know many corporations and organizations are putting in sufficient, or what we hope are sufficient, but significant security procedures on their systems. I know we do here in our office. We have a lot of safeguards that we use, and I know a lot of other organizations are, but this is now a specific requirement that we put into the contract. There also has to be a description of the procedures that the contractor will follow in notifying the district if there's an unauthorized release of data. This is something that we've been advising our clients to do for some time now in addendums to contracts because we have had incidents of breaches where information has gotten out from the between the third party and the school district. And so there should be information in there as to that notification period that I know both Ben and Bill are going to talk about a little bit more in terms of what happens when there's a breach. But that's very important. It's also going to be important relative thereto to identify a contact person. That's one of the most significant things that we think that should be included in these contracts is who exactly is notified. Is it the superintendent? Is it the IT director? Who is in your district who is going to be responsible for taking in those kinds of contacts? There's also a statement has to be in there that student data should not be retained or available to the contractor upon completion of the contract services unless the student, parent, or legal guardian chooses to establish an outside separate relationship. So once that contract ends, that information should not be retained by the contractor, whether it's returned in hard copy or there's some assurance that it's deleted and anything that remains is then returned to the Board of Ed. It's also required to have a statement that the contractor and the Board of Ed ensure compliance with FERPA, again, which is really what we've been required to do for some time now. We also required to include a statement that Connecticut law governs the rights and duties of the parties. This, I think, from my experience working with contractors in the past, as a very broad term, it might certainly create some difficulty relative to negotiation of contracts because contract law varies by state. But this is now a legal requirement in Connecticut, and there's not a lot of wiggle room. They agree or they don't agree, and we've been talking a lot here in our office that it's not just Connecticut that's doing this. There are a lot of laws coming about from other states that include very similar provisions. So in our opinion, operators are kind of going to have to get on board with a lot of this or are going to have some more difficulty engaging our services. And the last statement that's required, and again, these are minimum requirements of the contract. So boards of ed through their council or otherwise can certainly make their contracts more robust, include different provisions and additional provisions, not different, additional provisions that address the specific needs of the district and the needs of the contract. So the final is a statement that a court finding of invalidity invalidity of any contract provision doesn't invalidate the entire contract. This is a pretty standard provision in most contracts, but not often seen in terms of service, and not often seen in just very general, you know, contracts. So that does now have to be in there as well. I'm going to talk quickly about notification, and then I'm going to turn it over. But there is a very specific notification requirement with regard to these contracts. So within 5 days, business days, which is important in our school world, business days of executing a contract with a contractor, we have to electronically notify students, a student who the contract applies, to whom the contract applies, and the parent. So that's actually a separate notification requirement, the student and the parent or guardian of the student affected. And such notice has to be posted on the district's website along with the actual contract. So what kind of gets flagged out from here is that we want to make sure that that notice and that contract is not personally identifiable, doesn't include personally identifiable information, because it is public. So as best as we can, otherwise we have to make sure that we're redacting certain information. So there are definitely issues around that publication. We want to make sure that we're not releasing any information that we shouldn't be, which is the purpose of the contract in the name of them. We also have a notification requirement, and I'm going to leave to Bill and Ben to talk a little bit more about when contractors have to notify the Board of Ed, but the Board of Ed's requirement is to notify parents, affected parents and students within 48 hours of notice of a breach. So we get notice from an operator or a consultant that there's been a breach of security relative to student information. We have 48 hours to notify students and their parents who are involved in such breach. We also have to post notice of the breach on our website. So this is all about transparency, no doubt. It's from the federal level, you know, down to the states now, there's a huge push for transparency in what is going on relative to student information, and this law is doing just that. So I'm going to hand it over to Ben, who is going to talk a little bit more about what contractors are required to do. We thought it was important to address the contractor and the specific operator requirements also, because these are things that districts might want to build into their contracts to make assurance that there's notification of the operators and consultants as to what they have to be doing on their end, which just gives a little more protection to boards of ed. So, Ben.
Hi, my name is Ben Frazzini-Kendrick. I'm an associate here at Shipman & Goodwin. Thank you very much, Gwen. And so I'm going to address what contractors specifically have to do independent of the contract. I think a lot of these things that I'm going to talk about here briefly are already in the contract, but these requirements, you know, for whatever reason, if the contract is void or somehow the requirements don't make it into the contract, they would still be bound to these provisions under the law, independent of what the contract requires them to do. And it's important to keep in mind that these requirements apply to both operators as well as to consultants. So as Gwen touched on earlier, you know, it's not just about the electronic data. It's also could be about paper records that you may have with a consultant who provides non-educational services. So there's three significant obligations that the bill imposes on contractors. The first is that all student-generated content remains the property of the student or the student's parent or legal guardian. The second is that contractors must implement and maintain security procedures and practices to protect student information or student data generally from unauthorized access, use, disclosure, et cetera, in a manner that's consistent with federal law and with industry standards. And third, and in my mind, this is perhaps more the most significant, is contractors are prohibited from using student records for any purposes other than those the contract authorizes, which, as Gwen stated earlier, has to be a contract provision, but also prohibits them from using personally identifiable information contained in student records for targeted advertising. And this is a theme that a lot of states have started to adopt, is that there's a prohibition against using information that a operator or a consultant gathers from the student's use of their programs to then try to sell products to the student. And just as Gwen mentioned a minute ago, in terms of the Board of Ed requirement to notify parents and guardians, the contractors have an obligation to notify the Board of Education if they become aware that there's any type of a data breach. And here is one place where it's helpful to break out from the from student data these particular definitions, because there's a different notification requirement based on whether or not it's student information that's being released, or if it's student records and student-generated content that's somehow been released. So if there's a data breach with regard to student information, upon discovery of the breach, a contractor must notify the Board of Education of the breach within 30 days. In the event that there's a breach of information with regard to student records or student-generated content, the contractor must notify the local or regional Board of Ed in 60 days of that breach. And during that time, the contractors have some things that they're able to do. But it kind of gives you a sense of the timeline that they're operating under. Again, it's also, you know, it's again important to remember this applies to both operators and consultants, and that consultants who have access to paper records have to have, you know, have to provide notice of breach of a, you know, security breach just as an operator would. And so I think that that's, you know, that's my kind of general overview about what contractors have to do. I'm going to turn it over to Bill now to speak briefly about what operators in particular have to do.
I'm going to jump in just one second, just to follow up on what Ben was saying about the notification period. We were shaking our heads a little bit that of the inconsistent, well, not inconsistent, but oddness of the law that Board of Ed has 48 hours to notify a student or a parent of a breach, but an operator or a consultant has 2 months in some cases, which seems odd to us. Nothing prohibits a Board of Ed from contracting with an operator or a consultant to be required to notify the Board of Ed within a shorter period of time. It's somewhat of our understanding that there were a few laws bouncing around and they all kind of merged into one. So we too thought that that was somewhat odd, but again, by contract, a board could certainly require a shorter period of time for notification if that were to be agreed to, of course, under the terms of the contract by the contractor. So, Bill.
Sure. Hi. My name is Bill Roberts. I'm also an associate here at Shipman and Goodwin, and I don't want to repeat too much of what already has been said. I think a lot of the operator requirements have been addressed, but I did want to comment a bit more on the breach issue. As Gwen mentioned, as Ben went through, there's two categories of breach reporting. One which is 30 days for breaches involving student information, and one for 60 days regarding breaches involving directory information, student records, or student-generated content. There's a lot of concerns and a lot of ambiguity in the breach statute. First, I do want to emphasize that the 30 and 60 days are the outer limit. In both cases, the operator or the consultant must notify without unreasonable delay. And that is a term which is used in many breach statutes, including in the financial world, in the healthcare sector. And generally, from a government regulator perspective, if you wait the 30 days or the 60 days, there's needs to be a very good reason for the operator to be waiting that long. There's also, as Gwen mentioned, a very serious concern from a board perspective that a vendor may, and in this case, the operator, for example, a mobile app company and an online service company, that they will know of a breach and sit on it for potentially 60 days. And that is potentially problematic for many reasons. First, as an organization, you want to know when your data has been breached as soon as reasonably possible. so that you can respond to it, you have knowledge of it, and you can seek to mitigate any harm or damage that may be arising. Second is, as Gwen mentioned, in turn, once you receive notice, you only have 48 hours to provide notice. And one thing which is, and even though that's extremely quick, it's actually faster than virtually any other data breach law that I'm aware of, that raises some concerns from the board aside from just turning it around, and we'll go through those. First is that there's a concern anytime you are notifying parents or students of a breach, that you're notifying them of a breach that happened 2 months ago. And that the first question the parents and students will ask is, if the breach happened in January, why am I only learning about it now in March? And reliance upon the law, sending someone a statute, is not going to win over that, you know, those disgruntled parents or students. So we certainly think that boards will want to consider a more aggressive breach reporting timeline, akin to what you see in healthcare or finance, where entities are also given 60 days. But in practice, no one wants to be waiting that long. The second point I want to talk about is this 48-hour notice. When you receive notice from an operator of a breach, and you have 48 hours to turn around notices to students and parents and a website notice, the only way that's going to practically happen is that you have a breach response plan in place ahead of time. 48 hours, I can't emphasize enough, is extremely quick. Most of our clients in other sectors struggle to turn out a notice in 2 weeks. So to have something out in 2 days is a Herculean effort. Certain things the board wants to be thinking about. What do you want? What information do you want in that notice from the operator? Is it just that a breach happened? Unlike many breach laws you may be familiar with, this statute doesn't include notification content requirements, and that's very odd. What the board wants to be going through is in this breach response plan, say, when we notify parents and students, what do we want to tell them? And what you want to tell your parents and your students is what you want to require from the operator. So you want to know what happened, when it happened, what data was compromised, what students were affected, how many students were affected, what did the operator do in response. These are the kind of questions you'll be getting from parents and students, and the only way you could answer those is by obtaining this information from the operator. And as a word of caution, never rely upon, especially in a breach, which is a contentious adversarial context, never rely upon the goodwill of the operator or the software company to provide you what you need. As we've been talking about this, we're very concerned about boards being in a very difficult bind when they receive notice of a breach, but then in turn don't have the knowledge or the content necessary to provide a thoughtful and responsive and helpful notice to parents and students. So in short, boards certainly want to be thinking about when going through these contracts is maybe we want notice quicker. Maybe we want a bifurcated notice saying, you know, the first notice is dear board, something happened, you know, and you may want to require that within 48 hours. It doesn't take very long to pick up the phone to call you or send you a quick email saying that an incident is occurring. And then at some later time, perhaps 10 or 20 days later, to provide a more thorough breach report. Other things to be thinking about is, as Gwen mentioned, who is going to be receiving these notices? If you only have 48 hours to respond to a notice, you can't waste a single hour in having the person who receives these notices not being available, being out sick, not checking email. This law doesn't allow for that type of delay. And who is going to be providing the the notice, how are you going to handle printing? If you need to send notices to 1,000 people, in terms of what if you don't have all of the electronic contact, how else are you going to be doing it? You need to be thinking about these things ahead of time and really think out in these 48 hours how we're going to make the most of each hour we have available to us. And with that, there's also some concerns regarding follow-up. You do want to be thinking about, once you send out these notices, who is going to be responsible for receiving questions from parents? What are the talking points? What is the story you're going to be telling? Who are they to contact? You want to think about the entire life cycle of the breach. And with that, I think now might be a good time to move on to some questions. We received ahead of time, many of you likely received a communication from Doug Casey to collect some questions. Doug has provided those to us, and there's certain themes in the questions, so we're going to use our time to address those and address the questions that seem most pertinent to the audience.
Okay. Wait,
do you want to start with that?
Yeah, I'm going to start going through, and you're going to hear the three of us chime in with our responses, because thanks to Doug, we were able to see them in advance, which is very helpful to us, especially with the new law. We want to be very thoughtful about the responses that we're providing. So I'm going to start by going through one by one. There is some overlap, so some of them we're going to skip over because either we've addressed them or they were addressed within another question. So the first question is a bit specific, so we're going to do the best we can. It is, I would like confirmation that I think it's pronounced GAFE, G-A-F-E, and 0365, which is, I think, Office 0365, would be considered exempt as they are marketed to the general population, not students, and we just have a special management arrangement. So there is a portion of the operator law that is kind of a catch-all exemption, meaning it states toward the end of the Public Act, nothing in this law is meant to apply to, and it lists, like, a bunch of different things. So I'm going to have Bill respond to this question because he's our technology expert.
Sure. I just want a very quick disclaimer that we're not providing any specific advice on this call regarding a specific app or any product. But I do want to reinforce the definition of operators in terms of online services such as Google Apps or Office. That there's two elements you want to be focused on when you're looking at your contract and saying, is this particular vendor an operator? The product is designed and marketed for school purposes. And that's an important thing there is the law doesn't say only for school purposes. So simply because someone else may also be using it in some context isn't necessarily going to take that application out of the law. The operator has actual knowledge that schools are using it. I think that would satisfy, as long as there's any sort of marketing effort by a software company to promote this product in schools, I think that would be satisfied. And then lastly, the product collects, maintains, or uses personally identifiable student information, which, as Gwen mentioned, is the same definition as used under FERPA, which most of you are likely aware. I think a good rule of thumb for approaching this is that each online service with which you contract should be looked at individually. But I think we should try to avoid, painting certain categories of apps with the same stroke or certain types of products. You really do want to go through a careful online service by online service analysis. Just really quick here, Google Apps for Education, depending upon the app, depending upon how it's used, depending upon how it's marketed in the design, it would appear to us that that would fall under the auspices of this statute. While Office 365, unless there is some something special about a certain school version or certain school product line or service, it likely would not. Not every online service, not every technology application in your school will be under this law. It does need to meet these specific definitions, and the only way to really determine that is a case-by-case analysis.
Great. So the second question, or more of a statement, this participant found it interesting that the new law doesn't address the parent opt-out clause. Interestingly, a prior version of the bill did. So a prior version of the bill, just kind of as a side note, it's always interesting to know how a bill becomes the law, a prior version included that a very broad and blanket option for a parent to opt out of any of these contracts. In our analysis of that, I think it was reasonable that it was removed, although it's clear that there's a very significant concern from parent advocates about student information, rightfully so. Certainly we've all heard about a variety of breaches over even just the last couple of months, and certainly the last couple of years. However, given the current day and the use of technology in our schools, it certainly would have been a complicating factor to allow that general broad opt-out from use of, for example, student data systems or, IP Direct or things of that nature. So I don't think that it was too surprising that it was removed in the final version, although I wouldn't be surprised if over the next few years we start to see even some revisions of this law, because that certainly does happen also, as we have seen. The next question is a pretty broad one, and this will bring us to a discussion of terms of service and terms of use, which I know the three of us are very interested in talking about generally. So the question is, define written agreement. And I think it really should say written contract, which is what is written into the law. It says written contract. There are online terms of service, terms of use that we agree to when we use applications. So we're all very familiar with opening up an app and pushing a button that says agree. And I'm totally guilty of not reading that fully all the time. And we push agree. And I think that is happening in our classrooms. And I think that depending on what school district you're in, some teachers have very, very broad latitude to push accept. And there aren't a lot of structures in place, although I know that there are some school districts with whom I've worked where the district has a pretty comprehensive procedure for use of software or use of applications, free or not. And I think that's going to be very important here. So you're going to have to agree to a terms of use, terms of service, whether or not you pay for an app or not sometimes. And that was another question that came up, but I'll address it quickly now. There's no specification as to payment in this law. So whether it's free or a fee for service is not going to matter. These terms apply. So those terms of service are going to come with all of your apps, generally speaking. If we're currently using these applications prior to October 2016, are we required to have a written agreement that is signed by the contractor in order to continue using these? So it's a multi-part question that I think each of us will try and address a little bit. I'm going to start out by saying there's no definition of written contract. We've talked about that already. There's actually no requirement that it be signed. So technically speaking, these terms of use, terms of service, will act as your written contract, which means that it has to have these terms. That said, it doesn't apply till October 1st. So if there are apps that you are using, nothing in this law prohibits you from using things for which you have already engaged the services. However, and I want Bill to address this a little further, terms of service are often renewed without us knowing about it.
Yeah, some of you who've had a lot of free time and maybe spent 3 hours reading the terms of service to some of your mobile apps or online services, most terms and conditions include two provisions which are particularly troublesome in this context. First is that most terms of service include auto renewals without notice. So what that means is the contract, the term of service, will continue to renew without the school being notified of that. And what's a problem here is that the this law applies to contracts entered into before October 1st, 2016. So it applies to your contracts, your terms of service you have now, only when the existing contracts are renewed or revised after October 1st, 2016. I don't want you to get too comfortable saying we have a terms of service now, so we don't have to worry about this law for this particular product. But that term of service may say it renews automatically on November 1st, 2016, and that the software company does not need to notify you of that. At that point, that auto-renewal brings that contract, that term of service, and that product under this law. Similarly, most terms of service grant the software company the right to revise the term of service contract at any time for any reason without any notice to the board. This, too, may mean that on October 2nd, 2016, your software company vendor revises the term of service. That means that that term of service also needs to comply with this law. So that's going to be a very challenging task for boards to not only identify all of the vendors, identify who is falling under this, but also identify how to address these issues that arise from terms of service that will be come under this law but may not, most likely would not, comply with all of the contractual terms that Gwen mentioned at the beginning of the call.
Great. Thanks, Bill. We're gonna push through a little bit because we got a little more than 10 minutes left. So the next question is the state going to approach contractors that most schools use to accept the language that the state is requiring? And an example of Massachusetts was given and that there are a number of contractors that declined to sign contracts. We certainly hope so, but we don't know. There's a task force that is ordered pursuant to this law with a number of different stakeholders, and they are required to issue a report by January of 2017, which is very soon. It's a very quick process, and they are essentially tasked with a number of things, one of which is looking at the feasibility of putting together a list. But we don't know the answer to the question. It's certainly going to be a challenge in some respects to contract. We realize that. We recognize that. But we don't have much of an option at this point. But again, there are other states that are doing very similar things. And we talked about this a little bit already, but contractors are going to have to get on board, specifically the operators. I don't think that you're going to have as many issues with your consultants. I think that the operators is going to be the bigger issue. Okay, so there was a very general question about how does this operationalize our work? And we've talked about this already a little bit, but I think, and feel free to chime in, Bill and Ben, I think that it's going to be very important to do an inventory in the first instance. Because, yes, it is going to impact the daily operation of business as we know it in the schools. But I think that we can do our best to make it an easier process by first having inventorying, seeing what we use and how we're using it, and putting in not necessarily board policies, although I'll talk about that in a minute, and there should be some changes to your existing policies. But I think having a manual that explains how we do this now will be very helpful for districts. And it doesn't have to be a massive policy change again, although, again, there are some changes, but putting together a description of the procedures that we go through in using technology, in using student records, and the process to go through, and making that very clear to all staff, anyone involved in almost any aspect of student information. We'll have to know.
Yeah, and I think that's very important. When I was reading this bill and kind of thinking about it, one of the things that I started thinking about as a former classroom teacher is that it seems like the type of information that schools collect kind of fall into one of three categories. One is that information that district staff enters on behalf of the students, sort of like IEP Direct, I think to an extent like Power Schools. The second type of information is information that a student may enter. A student may use an app and kind of put in whatever information is required. The third is information that the app collects as a result of use, not as a result of direct entry, but an app may track, for example, how long a student takes to answer a question, how long a student views a certain page before clicking through to another page, how frequently the student uses the app on a monthly basis, all of which may be entirely unbeknownst to the user by looking at the app on its face. And then I was also thinking that there are sort of three levels or three categories of applications or programs and web-based services that districts and that they use. One is those that are used on the district level. Each school district may have a contract for everyone, every special education teacher in the district to use IEP Direct, for example. The second level are those that are used on the school level. A high school in a district may have a contract for use of a certain type of program that is not of use to an elementary school, et cetera. And then the third are those used by individual teachers in their classrooms. And so where I perceive the biggest challenge for districts being are sort of those bottom-level categories where it's a program or a service that's used by a classroom teacher and it collects information from a student based on the student's use. That's really going to be where districts may struggle with compliance with this. I think that, when you're looking at it, sort of a district-wide program that district personnel are entering information into directly, that's sort of obvious that, we need to comply with the law when we're using or engaging that service. But it's going to be more difficult to look at exactly what are teachers in each classroom doing. What applications are they using, and are those applications collecting information that is not apparent on its face? So I agree entirely with what Gwen was saying, that I think that one of the first things that districts need to do to get a handle on this law is to really conduct an inventory of where we're at, what are we using, what are individual teachers using, and how do we begin to kind of investigate what each of those applications and services, et cetera, does.
Great. So there's one question that I think is a bit quick, and the question is, how is this change helpful to constituents, the obvious and not-so-obvious benefits to the average person, and look at our constituents as our students and parents. And the clear intent of the law is transparency. This is a national theme. I participated in national presentations and webinars, and that it is absolutely clear that that's the push. That's the push from the federal government, from PTAC, which is the organization through the Department of Ed at the federal level, that students and parents should know where their information is being stored and what their information is being used for, if anything, specific to education or otherwise. So that's clearly where this is coming from. The next, I kind of want to address the two questions together. One is training and one is policies. So training is going to be pretty important from the technology perspective and from just the records perspective in general. We should be providing our staff, specifically teachers and anyone who has access to student information. We should be providing training on confidentiality of student information, at least once, certainly, but ongoing training is always a good idea on issues such as this. So we see this as an arm of student confidentiality requirements, and now we have it, an information technology component with it as well. And it's really, again, should be any individual within the school environment who has access to student records needs to know about this. I do a lot of work in the special ed realm, and I see this as impacting the delivery of special education services significantly, especially with the push for the use of assistive technology, which is a recent big push in the special ed realm. So all of those individuals should be trained that it's not going to be okay anymore just to decide that a student should use a certain program without ensuring that that program and the use of that program is compliant with this law. So training, yes, is going to be very important. The next I want to address is policies. This is going to be very district-specific. Different school districts have different policies and have different perspectives on policy use. Some districts have many, many policies. Some have far fewer. So which policies will be impacted will certainly depend on your specific Board of Ed and the manner in which that Board of Ed chooses to make policy work. From our perspective, you should certainly be looking at your student records and student confidentiality policy to ensure compliance with this law. It's also probably a good idea to be looking at your use of electronic and computer systems, district use of computer systems, as we call it. I know different people have different names for it, policies. So how are electronics being used? It may or may not be impacted, but it's a good idea to take a look or request your counsel to take a look at it. It may also be a good idea to take a look at any of your purchasing policies and see if any additions to policy or regulations are required or any impact it might have there. Some districts have pretty involved purchasing policies in terms of RFPs, and you might want to take a look at how you're going out to RFP and what information you're requesting. Again, it's very, very specific to each Board of Ed. One more that I want to address, and then I can turn it over to my colleagues here, but there was a question about how this impacts unions. We don't see a huge impact on unions, although you just never know. But, you know, the bargaining requirement would be for a change in working conditions very likely, and this is less of a significant change in an impact than it would just be a change in process and procedure kind of from a higher-up district level. So certainly there may be very specific situations where discussion with the union may be necessary depending on your individual contracts. It's certainly something we always want to keep in the back of our minds. But on the outset, on the face of the law, we haven't identified anything as of yet. Just two more questions that we have here. The question about if there are questions about this law, who do I go to? Certainly consult your counsel. If you have specifics on the application of the law to your specific needs and your specific district. I know we had spoken with Doug again about doing a follow-up in the fall possibly. Maybe we'll have some more information. Maybe after the task force comes out with their recommendations, we'll have some more information. One of the final questions, are there guidelines, considerations that various stakeholders need to be apprised of, such as checklists or tools that we can share? And Bill, I'll chime in with you, but as of right now, we are not knowledgeable about any documents like this.
No. Okay. No, we aren't. But we expect there may be some, you know, either arising from Connecticut or from other states that may be similar and may be used as a template or at least a first place to be starting.
Great. So that brings us to nearly exactly 12 o'clock, which is amazing because that doesn't always happen. And we really appreciate everyone listening. And, again, this is being taped. I know, Doug, you'll probably do a little conclusion, but feel free to share this with people in your district who have, you know, need to know about this information as well. Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gwen, Bill, and Ben, thank you for the outstanding overview and, of the new law and how we can get ready for the changes to district policies and processes. You've done an amazing job of covering a huge amount of ground in just an hour. As I said at the onset, we're recording the call, so we will be posting this digitally and sharing it with folks who registered for the conversation. And as Gwen indicated, there'd probably be some kind of in-person event as things progress. So everybody out there, appreciate your attending, and I know that there is probably a good amount of planning and work ahead, but we hope this was useful for you as a launching pad. So take care, everybody. Have a happy Monday, and we'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.